morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order, and thank you very much for being here today. We have a number of bills, or three bills, that we're actually going to be considering for public hearings and possible work sessions. We have House Bill 2205A, based on the availability of Representative Hoyle, who's one of the prime sponsors and instigators on the bill. We will not have that bill until about 9 o'clock, so we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on 2710.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2710 comes to you from Representative Hoffman, and basically it puts restrictions on law enforcement for the use of drones, allows a law enforcement agency to use a drone for the purposes of surveillance of a person only if a court has issued a warrant or the drone is used within a geographically confined time-limited emergency in which the risk of serious physical harm to an individual is thoroughly documented by law enforcement. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you also have in front of you the Dash 2 amendments, which is where we left off with Senate Bill 71.
All right, thank you. So, Representative Hoffman, why don't you come up first, and do you want to bring anyone else up with you in your presentation? If not, we'll just take them in order.
It'll be at the chair's pleasure. I can kick it off.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, committee. John Huffman, for the record, out of House District 59. Thanks for hearing House Bill 2710 today. I think the chair will explain to everybody that it's still a work in progress. Discussions are continuing with a large stakeholder group, some of those you will hear from today. But I think the argument for having statewide guidelines for the use of drones or unmanned aerial vehicles is possibly stronger today than it was back in January and February when we first really started kicking off the discussions within the building. It's something that I've been working on for year and a half. Bill and I have batted the topic back and forth, and we were just chatting about how fascinating the topic is. And I'm excited about what we're doing here in Oregon because I think our conversation has sustained itself through the session, whereas we've witnessed in other parts of the country, from Seattle to Virginia, we've seen everything from municipalities putting a moratorium on the use of drones while they study the issue. We've seen states say no drones for 2 years while we study the issue. In Oregon, we've been fortunate enough to have the stakeholders come to the table and keep the conversation moving along and trying to create some guidelines that, number one, gives Oregonians, I think, what they deserve from the Oregon legislature, and that's support of their individual right to privacy. So that, I think, is one of our number one goals. Also to give a thriving industry in Oregon, the UAV industry, some certainty that we're not going to be pulling the rug out from under them, and that companies like Boeing in situ out of the gorge that employs roughly 750 people between the two states in the gorge area will continue to be able to do what they're doing. Large contingent of folks in the central Oregon area will continue to be able to develop and produce drones, and there are other areas, McMinnville area, quite a few of them around the state. It's quite a burgeoning industry. I want to make sure that law enforcement understands that we don't want to be too restrictive, that they'll be able, under certain circumstances, to use drones for surveillance and other information gathering, uses for search and rescue by sheriff's department or whomever. We've heard some wonderful stories about how lives have been saved with the use of drones for search and rescue. Hobbyists enjoy taking the drones out and using those, and I have no desire to hinder the use of drones. It's come up in a number of hearings, and I've said, well, I think we have enough civil penalties on the books that if an individual, a hobbyist, uses a drone for something and it's against current laws, that will be taken care of in a normal judiciary process. Agriculture has come out that they're extremely interested in the possibilities for the future use of drones in surveying their crops, checking water, pests, maybe even for spraying one of these days. And we don't want to hinder that use and the possibilities there. Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife have already been working with in situ, doing some testing to find out how ODFW might be able to use drones in tracking and doing elk herd counts and wolf surveys and things of that nature. And we don't want to restrict that use, but we do want to be careful in any additional use that they have. If ODFW says they're sending a drone out to cover this elk herd and they're going across Frank's ranch and they happen to see something else, we want to make sure that that information isn't freely given to another government subdivision or agency. So I think that's kind of the purposes of where we're headed with this, and be happy to answer any questions, but I think the testimony that follows me is going to express some of the sentiment behind the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Huffman? John, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to go ahead and just call people up that are just going to go down the list, basically. I've got Daryl Fuller, Kevin Campbell, and Patrick Sherman. And while they're getting set, as Representative Huffman said, the bill is not going to be worked today. There is an agreement that House Bill 2710 would be our quote-unquote vehicle to be used for not only the concepts and perspectives that he has brought forward in the bill, but also some of the stuff that we had worked on in this committee under Senate Bill 71. So, gentlemen, whoever would like to start.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Appreciate the hard work that Senator Brzezinski, Representative Huffman, and others are doing trying to craft a bill that makes sure that we're a magnet for the industry, that we protect people's civil liberties, and that we provide law enforcement with the tools they need in order to do the jobs we have to do. Sheriffs are particularly concerned about making sure the bill does not restrict our ability to use drones for search and rescue and for surveillance under appropriate circumstances. The legislature is dealing with a bill that's sort of similar to this, has to do with red light cameras and what those pictures from red light cameras can or can't do in terms of assisting law enforcement. There's similar discussion on this bill when you have a warrant for a particular individual and you're following that individual. What other information that drone may collect during that warrant, what is or isn't used, can be used in law enforcement. And so we're particularly concerned about making sure that we put the appropriate sideboards up, but that we don't restrict law enforcement from doing its job. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Patrick or Kevin?
Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and I want to echo the comments that Mr. Fuller just offered to the committee. I think this is a very complicated area of law right now. It's confusing not just to the state of Oregon, but states around the United States are trying or struggling through how do you create law around this new technology. It obviously has difficulty because you have federal regulation involved. You have a new technology that's just on the cutting edge of things, and so there's going to be it's going to take quite an effort to accomplish the purpose of putting statute that really works. And I want to appreciate again, as Representative Huffman mentioned, the Oregon way of managing these kind of complicated issues. And I appreciate the fact that we've all been at the table having the conversation. I do want to echo Mr. Fuller's comments regarding our commitment to protecting privacy rights. And as new technologies come to the fore, as they will, and believe me, this is probably just the first of many new technologies, we do have a lot of confidence, both in our U.S. and our state constitution, and the court's ability to continue to protect privacy rights, which are intact regardless of new technologies. And so we think there is a court process that will continue to help us navigate this. That being said, obviously, this is an important area to the legislature to address. We want to make sure that we maximize the kind of benefits this might have without creating use of the drones that would impact privacy rights unnecessarily. I will say that there is an effort now nationwide to try to come together with a consistent kind of statute for states to look at, but it's not ready yet. It's being done by the Council of State Governments and the National Conference of State Legislatures. They're trying to help states navigate this because as you look at states around the nation, everybody's all over the map. I don't think there's any two pieces of legislation alike at this point. I will also mention that one of the things I appreciate about this effort is that if we can put together a state law that really works, we'd also like to see a moratorium on local government kind of moratoriums. It would be nice to have a consistent statute from location to location. With that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the time of the committee and your efforts to continue to work on a bill that works for everybody. Thank you.
Thank you. Patrick.
Hello. Good morning, Senator Brzezinski, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Sherman out of Tigard, Oregon, a member of the Roswell Flight Test Crew. We are hobbyists. However, we've had the opportunity to work with our colleagues in law enforcement and the fire service on a number of occasions demonstrating the capabilities of this technology, and it's based on that experience I wanted to come and talk to you today. First of all, we agree with the importance of protecting the privacy rights, and some process to get a warrant seems entirely appropriate. And these two gentlemen know far more about that than I probably ever will. That said, just based on our experience, we want to offer these recommendations. First of all, to be sure that sort of to have the rules reflect not only what happens when a drone is surveilling a suspect in a crime, but also in uses where no crime is suspected, like search and rescue, which he mentioned. I mean, as it happens, according to the Oregon Constitution, our sheriffs, law enforcement, is responsible for search and rescue. And if it's your brother out there with a broken leg in the woods, or your hospitalized mother who's wandered off with Alzheimer's, you're going to want whatever resources are available deployed as quickly as possible to find them. And so I just want to make sure that we didn't have people running off to try and get a judge to sign off on a warrant to conduct a search and rescue mission. I'm not expert enough to say how that not happened. And kind of in that vein, there are also other situations which might or might not be criminal where this technology could be a great benefit, such as accident investigation. You know, when two vehicles collide, there can be a great deal of time and effort spent to document that, and with guys going around on the middle with tape measures and taking photos on the ground, whereas a drone could go up in just a few seconds, provide a far more detailed and accurate image of that crash scene. Now, maybe the driver who caused the accident is a DUI, so maybe this will become evidence in a criminal case, or maybe it's just simply an accident. But it would be nice to have that resource available, because frankly, it's going to save the taxpayers money in terms of the crash scene reconstructionist going out to do that. So, and I have no idea how to implement that, but I just throw that out there as a use that doesn't seem to fit into this sort of black and white narrative. Also, we wanted to suggest, because this is what we do, is we make aerial videos, that the bill be amended with that 30-day deletion period. That's fine for sort of the general privacy rule if it's not evidence of a crime. But this having that in place would also make it impossible for law enforcement organizations to use this for, like, training purposes. If they went out and filmed their own SWAT team practicing maneuvering up to a house or something, they could only retain that for 30 days. It seems to make sense that if everyone in the video is a member of the law enforcement organization or maybe has a signed release because they're, you know, helping by being role players in a training scenario, that they should be allowed to retain that for longer for training purposes or for demonstration purposes. As this industry matures, it's going to be necessary to train new people to be drone pilots, and it might be more difficult to do that if they couldn't have a video to watch showing them how it's done. So I think so long as there's no impact on privacy of individual members of the public, they should be allowed to retain that for longer for sort of utilitarian internal purposes. And then finally, I just wanted to bring out that this this bill, as written, conflicts with the Oregon regulations, Oregon administrative regulations, in that, for example, a SWAT call out, you're required to retain all the records from that for 3 years after the incident, except, of course, under this bill for the drone footage, which you delete after 30 days. And my assumption is that Oregon's public records laws were put in place to protect individual citizens from the government, to make it possible for them to go back and review the decisions made on their behalf by public servants. And so it seems to me that that's an issue which hasn't been considered as to how this might be more broadly done. And then finally, just for the sake of keeping the law books clean, it would be nice to see this bill address that issue, either say this supersedes, you know, the public records requirements, or it doesn't, or just reconcile those. So that's the conclusion of my testimony. I'd be happy to take any questions, but I appreciate the opportunity to come out once again and talk to you.
Well, thank you very much. Question, Senator Roveland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we have in front of us 2710, dash ones and dash twos. So I guess my question is, do all of you see these as appropriate, or are there parts of them that you don't like?
Let me do this. I'm going to cut that if I can, Senator Roveland. We have a work group already designated that includes these gentlemen that are going to be meeting. Senator Cruz is also there. So this is really, I just wanted to get this out there, let people, and we're going to come back with a, let's say, more modeled finish.
Perfect.
That's all right.
Yeah, that's great.
There will be at least a dash three, I think, by the time.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Can I just ask a question about that, though? Who are the dash one and twos from? Is that from the work group?
Chair and members of the committee, the dash one will be for the House Judiciary Committee. They somehow got put over to this committee, too. Okay. I believe they came from the ACLU. Okay. The dash two are the Senate Bill 71, the last version that we had.
They looked awfully familiar.
Which is brought over to here for the purposes of
discussion.
Perfect.
Okay. So I did have one question then, which is something in the dash twos that I'm going to ask for input on, and we discussed this when we had a hearing on the Senate bill, which is the 400 feet number. I mean, is that something that's, maybe I should ask it to the chair, is this something consistent or to staff? That other states are looking at. One of the things that I understand about at this point, we don't have federal regulations on this. So making sure we're consistent, is this in line with what other states are looking at? Because last time I heard, it's hard for us to determine. If you're going 450 versus 400 feet, make sure that that's a reasonable.
Senator Dingfelder, with the committee's permission, I may be able to answer your question. Could you tell me what the bill states with regards to that 400-foot limit?
Well, it was discussed last time, and it's not the bill. It's the dash two amendment.
Okay.
It talks about the 400-foot that in the Section 7, it talks about you would bring an action against any person who operates a drone that has flown at a height of less than 400 feet of the property if, and then it lists some conditions.
400 feet is a sort of a significant measure in model aviation because that's the limit which was established in, I believe, 1983 as the ceiling for model aircraft to operate. And the reason that was chosen is because that's provide a space cushion between manned aircraft, which generally are not supposed to operate below 1,000 feet, so a nice cushion there. I'm not certain where the 400-foot limit came from in this bill. My concern with that limit as established in Senate Bill 71 was sort of twofold. One, that I want the maximum space between manned and unmanned aircraft to reduce the chance of a collision or some sort of unfortunate interaction. And so, if 400 feet is an arbitrary number, let's make it 300 feet just so we can have more cushion. And the second, so 400 feet, just from my experience as an operator, seems too high for most of what you're going to want to do. So that's it. So my concern is basically just that people would fly too high. Any competent drone operator is going to know by means of their telemetry what their actual altitude is moment by moment. But my concern is people are going to fly higher than they have to get over that limit just to keep themselves safe from the possibility of a lawsuit when they don't need to go that high in order to accomplish whatever it is they're there to do. So unless there's some highly compelling reason to maintain that limit, I'd suggest it go away.
Thank you.
All right. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We have two panels for this group, for this bill. Becky Strauss, Dale Meyer, and Jim Welsh. And just to let everyone know, I have two other bills with a number of people who want to be testifying. We've got coming up on an hour, so I'm going to have to start limiting time if we need to.
I'll go ahead. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Becky Strauss here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. I am here in support of 27-10 with the dash one amendments. I did testify on the hearing on Senate Bill 71, so that's the dash twos here today, and I'm not going to talk too much about those because I'm going to let my testimony from that hearing prevail, and we'll take those concerns to the work group. But just briefly, our two concerns with the dash two are, one, on heightening criminal penalties for existing crimes when they're committed with a drone. We think it's appropriate to state that you can commit the crime with a drone and you will be subject to the existing penalty, but we are concerned with the heightened criminal penalty. The second concern in regard to the Dash 2 is the standard being used for law enforcement use, which is the federal standard of a reasonable expectation of privacy standard, whereas the Oregon courts use a more privacy protective standard, and we prefer that we use that standard for law enforcement use of drones here. So I'm going to focus now only on 2710 and the Dash 1, which we do hope will move forward. As has been mentioned before, there are, I believe right now the count is 39 states have introduced drone bills this session. I think there's high concern and interest in putting in place, from our perspective, clear and transparent guidelines for law enforcement use of drones. The issue of drones clearly is much broader, and more entities beyond law enforcement have an interest in their use, and our hope is that we can take a small, simple bite at the apple this session and look at guidelines for law enforcement. So that's our objective here. In regard to what the standard should be, there's been discussion of when a probable cause search warrant would be required for law enforcement to use aerial surveillance using drones. And so that is, we would like that to be the presumption, that law enforcement, when conducting surveillance with a drone, would have a probable cause warrant. And that's effectively what our bill says with the Dash 1. The bill as introduced would say that when a law enforcement agency is using drones for the purpose of surveillance of a person, that a probable cause warrant is required. The Dash 1 kind of puts in a catch-all that says that public bodies can be using drones for whatever they'd like if it doesn't fall in that specific surveillance of a person standard, but they may not use the footage that they obtain. So when I say whatever they may like, there's been discussion of land mapping or environmental uses, or certainly search and rescue is already encompassed in the underlying bill with an emergency exception. We don't want to shut off the innovation that may come forth with drones and what their uses may be. We just don't want them to be a backdoor to a warrantless search or mass surveillance without suspicion or probable cause. And so the Dash 1 would say that when a drone is being used for a purpose other than law enforcement, the footage that the drone collects may not be used then for a criminal, administrative, any type of adjudicatory proceeding later. We think that's a reasonable and a fair way to move forward. And House Bill 2710 has some additional provisions in regard to, as has been mentioned, destruction of the footage after a 30-day period unless the footage is needed for an ongoing criminal prosecution. There's a provision in the bill that says that public bodies may not use drones that are capable of being weaponized. There's a provision in the bill that would insert a system for public oversight. What we've seen in localities across Oregon is that new surveillance tools come into play, and they may be funded with federal dollars or they may not be. And localities have very little information about, or the public in those localities have very little information about what tools their law enforcement agencies are using. So some of the provisions here in 2710 are meant to say that when a local agency starts to use drones, they should come before their local body, whether it be the county board or the city council, and talk about that, talk about what their policies are. I believe the bill actually has a provision that those local boards need to approve the use for their local agency. So, for example, Portland City Council will need to approve the Portland Police Bureau's use of drones when and if they are approved by the FAA to use them. So that very briefly is what the bill does, and we have certainly appreciated the ongoing conversations and look forward to further conversations. I know there are many, many interests at the table, and we're doing our best to make sure that the very simple concept that we're trying to put in place, which is to import the probable cause standard into this new technology, which is drone surveillance, that doing so does not hinder all other uses or interests or hamstring our law enforcement agencies from doing what they're meant to do. If I might just conclude with,
if you can, as I said,
you need to.
We're going to be part of the work group. You're part of the work group, so if you can give us this, the summary, because we're going to be coming back, everyone you can reach. But, you know, I've got two other bills that we need to have testimony on today.
I think I can conclude. I've submitted written testimony also. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Chair Przonski, members of the committee. Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, I did submit written testimony. What I did not put in it, I'd like to say today, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. Right now, on the linear plane of the flat surface of the earth, a person can put up a no trespassing sign over their gate to their driveway, and it means something. And the question really is, how do we maintain those privacy rights now that we're talking about vertical leveled surveillance? Drones are different. What we would like to see in an ideal bill, and we don't think that it's present yet in the 2710 or any of its amendments, is a clear expressed prohibition of public use except in limited expressed circumstances. To complicate things further, Senator Roblin, I've seen a -9 amendment to Senate Bill 71, but it nails it. It says, except as otherwise provided in sections blah, 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 a public body may not operate a drone, acquire information through the operation of a drone, or disclose information acquired through the operation of a drone, and then it sets forth expressed permitted uses. We think that's the preferred way to proceed. Once privacy rights are yielded to the government, you don't get them back. And we think best to capture maximal privacy rights and yield ground intentionally, expressly, and slowly. Let the experiment proceed elsewhere, learn from others' lessons, but proceed slowly. So we would like to see more express language than what we see in any of the versions right now floating around on 2710 of that express prohibition. I won't go into all the exceptions. I will just say I do think that the essential component of this is transparency and oversight so that the public later can figure out what it is government has been doing. To that effect, you absolutely have to have a paper trail. And again, I don't think that 2710 or any of its amendments really mandate that in the way that I would like to see done. We think that all agencies should have written policies. We think each use of a drone needs to be documented. We do think there needs to be a yearly audit of the use of drones. So that can be more fleshed out and transparent to the citizenry so they know what the government's doing as they're up there in the sky. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I have one other panel I need to get in today, so if y'all could step back. I've got Brigadier General Mike Caldwell and Tony Garcia.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department, and I'm having Captain Garcia hand out a proposed amendment that you can add to this this pile. As you know, we testified in Senate Bill 71 and offered to the committee our profound desire to be excluded from this particular law if it is passed. And there's reasons for that. It's not just because we're special or anything of the sort, but we have many restrictions on what we fly. We have about 100, well, more than 100 drones currently in the Oregon National Guard. Most of them are rather small, and they're used for tactical purposes, but we also have some larger ones that could be potentially weaponized. For instance, as you know, we do our helicopter work on Mount Hood, and we rescue probably 15-20 people a year off of that mountain, probably another 50 or so we rescue throughout the state when sheriffs call. If that particular phraseology was used for helicopters, because those helicopters can be weaponized with machine guns and other armaments, we couldn't do a rescue. And I think the same applies with whatever the future of drones may be or unmanned aerial systems that we have. Some of them could be. Now, back to what we do. As you know, we have very, very strict restrictions by the FAA and the Department of Defense on how we use these unmanned aerial systems. Currently, we can only fly at Boardman, which is restricted airspace by the FAA, the only restricted airspace in Oregon. And also, we can fly them at Camp Hialeah with a FAA approval. You can turn on and turn off your basic training needs. So we're suggesting here is that if we are exempt from that, because that's where we have to fly anyway, unless in the event that we're supporting local law enforcement, in which case we would fall under those restrictions that they have, because we're nothing more than a taxi driver. So they tell us where they're going. And so we would do that. In many cases, we do it today with certain types of equipment. The other issue concerns us is that we have other units, because of this restricted airspace near Boardman, we have other units from other states come in here all the time because it's such a unique situation, because restricted airspace is hard to find. So they're able to use that, and so we have other military units, both active duty and National Guard and Reserve. Like I said, we think that we have plenty of restrictions on us right now, and more state restrictions would, one, be a state expense, which we would have to hire, you know, employees to keep the records and do the things that are required in at least one of these versions. So the bottom line is we would like the version of Senate Bill 71 that excluded us, and I'll leave it at that. Do you have anything to add?
I have nothing to add, sir.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen, very much. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 2710. We're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2205A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2205A comes from Representative Gilliam and Hoyle and adds members of the Oregon Legislative Assembly, attorneys, dentists, and optometrists, and chiropractors to the list of those persons who must report elderly abuse, exempts attorneys, members of the clergy from reporting this information if received within their professional capacity, requires the Oregon State Bar to mandate training for lawyers on elderly abuse, reduces the statute of limitations for certain crimes committed against persons 65 years or old from 6 years to 3 years unless the prosecution was a result of report of elderly abuse, adds five members to the Oregon Elderly Abuse Work Group, directs the work group to study and make recommendations and align definitions of abuse of vulnerable persons across populations, agency, law enforcement, and service providers.
All right, thank you. So, representatives, I don't have a lot of other names on my list of who else would want to testify. So do you have other individuals besides yourselves that you want to be testifying?
We do. And
can you tell me who they are?
You bet. Detective Smith, who you've met before.
Matt
from
Smith.
Our...
Okay.
Yeah. And from the DA's office in Clackamas, Mr. Wentworth.
Well, why don't you all start off, and then we'll bring them up as a separate panel, and then I've got at least one other person. Thank you.
Great. For the record, Vic Gilliam, State Representative from District 18.
Val Hoyle, State Representative from House District 14, West Virginia, Junction City.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if it's okay, we've loaded up a short presentation. We'll just dive right in to keep moving. Thank you, and thank you to the committee members as well. Protecting Oregon seniors has had two parts. As you well know, you worked on the first bill, 4084, and now we're looking at sort of part two, which we think is a great complement to the first bill. I know, Mr. Chair, you know intimately the details of the first bill, but just a quick review, I'll just make a quick comment about the first bill. Senator Roblin voted on it as a state representative, as I recall. And the highlight for me in that bill was the extension of the statute of limitations as it relates particularly to financial fraud. And Detective Smith and DA Wentworth are going to specifically talk about how that bill has already helped us. And I think you'll enjoy the results of our work. So now we move on to House Bill 2205A. It's always important to point out that this is the result of elder abuse prevention work group. It's left out in that title, and I nearly lost votes last session over that. So it's all about prevention. So during the interim, the main goal was for the Patient Safety Review Council to meet. I highly recommend their report. They had a lot of hard work, went through boxes and boxes of material to get to several goals. And one of them is to continue their work and work collaborative with our stakeholders. As you well know, we have brought together everyone we believe involved or concerned about this, and feel good about the work that was done in that way. This new bill removes the sunset provision on law enforcement access to medical and financial health records. It strengthens financial records component. And I will move to the next slide. If there are any questions about these, you know, obviously you're welcome to interrupt or we can do it at the end.
One of the things y'all probably do not know is that we do not have fiscals on all of these amendments. So basically you're laying out the groundwork. We're going to then talk to you about which of the amendments you want. We may adopt those so we can get fiscals on those, but at this point we will not move the bill today.
The next slide we're probably going to skip over because your counsel, Mr. Taylor, has been very helpful, and we'll get to that when we discuss the dash issues, if that's okay. But that's what this slide had to deal with, and we'll move on and
It's already moved.
Thank you. The next slide, just to bring in the elder abuse mandatory reporting statute in line with child abuse. That's been one of our goals all along, to mirror that. And we add mandatory reporters, the list you can see there. The next slide is about extending elder abuse work group into 2015 with a more narrowed objective. One of the main points that came out of the patient review group was the lack of coordination or clear definition. And as you all know in your work in this committee, definitions in statute are extremely important. So they've urged us to make that a priority, and I think it'll make everything better in this field in statute. So we are making that a major goal of this bill. The next slide is about providing permissive language for district attorneys to partner with current team members in the administration of their multidisciplinary team responsibilities. And Senator Roblin and Senator Cruz may be particularly interested in this part because I think it is a acknowledgement that some of our counties have a great deal of difficulty putting together a multidisciplinary team. So we wanted the language to be permissive. These counties are not doing their multidisciplinary work because they don't want to. It's simply because it could be budgets, it could be resources, and so forth. So we thought that was an important thing for all disciplinary teams, to make that permissive rather than a mandate. And then lastly, I think the slide is about the dash 6, 7, and 9. Yeah, the 9 is up there. Regarding the 9s, again, keeping in mind we are trying to mirror the child abuse work that we've already done in this state. I'm going to stop there and ask my partner here if she has anything to add before we open it up to questions or move on.
I do not. This is a really good bill, and you'll hear after we leave about what this bill, when we passed it previously, actually has allowed law enforcement and DHS to do in terms of stopping abuse of elders and allowing elders to keep their financial resources that they earned. It's a good bill, and we'd like to have your support. Now, in terms of the amendments, do you want to speak to which amendments we'd like passed?
The three that are up there, let me just ask, are those three necessary to complete the work of your group?
We believe they are because they clarify some areas that interested parties have come in and said, this would be better.
What I'm going to ask, since we're more than likely going to be adopting those today, ask the committee if you want any explanations on the 6, 7, and 9. They're in your packet.
You need to do.
And if we need to, my understanding, there are more technical type of fixes and tightening down the work that's already in the main bill.
Mr. Chair, if you please, I'd rather have the testimony and then discuss those. Okay. I think it'd be a better context.
One question, who is that?
Who is that? She's already identified
herself.
I'll say it again. Val Hoyle, representing West Eugene and Junction City.
They did the I'm proud to do so. At the beginning, I thought they were going to do this trade-off like they usually do, you know, the dog and pony show.
I'm not going to go any further with that one. So.
Yeah, I just wanted to make one comment. I don't know if one of the members sitting up there heard yesterday, but there was a loud cheer when we finally were able to evacuate the building from the fire alarm yesterday, and we saw the car come out of the garage and the two people safely get out and go away from the building as well. us standing on the other side. And I just wanted to make sure that I was happy to see you were safe and back here today.
Yeah. Thank you, and I'm certainly glad you have him on your side of the building.
So do we.
Good.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
It's the drone surveillance that we had on that.
That's right.
If I could, Mr. Chair, I support this bill. I would request that the sponsors of the bill also take a look at the Dash A8 amendment and tell us what you think of that one as well. Different subject, but also I think an important one to consider.
All right.
Thank you.
Will do. Thank you.
All right. If y'all would be so kind to step back, Matt Smith, and I'm sorry, I didn't hear who the ADA is that's here.
John Wentworth.
John Wentworth.
John? Please come forward.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, Senators of the Committee. My name is John Wentworth. I'm a prosecutor with the Clackamas County District Attorney's Office. I specialize in the prosecution of elder abuse and run our county's multidisciplinary team that focuses on elder abuse. I'm here as a representative of the Oregon District Attorney's Association as well. I was part of the work group that you're now aware of, and can tell you there was an enormous amount of work that went into creating this bill, and a great deal of support that came from all sorts of disciplines, including the banking industry, law enforcement, prosecutors, and social services. What the bill that you have before you does many things that are of great benefit to seniors in the state of Oregon. From my standpoint, one of the most important and beneficial aspects of the bill is the mandatory reporting provision that brings it in line, the reporting requirements in line with those of child abuse. And the reason that's significant is, believe it or not, there are a number of people out there, and I see this in the work that I do, there are a number of people out there who sometimes see things occur and tell themselves somebody ought to do something about that. And that somebody is oftentimes the person who's actually witnessing what's going on. I can give you an example of a friend of mine who is an emergency room nurse who had an elder abuse case come into the ER. And he was telling me about this because he knows the work that I do, and I should add that he's a former reserve police officer. There was a debate within the emergency room about whether anyone should report this. And the decision was made not to report it because they felt, well, we're not required to. Now, that's a travesty, because instead of saying, well, even though we don't know whether we have to or not, and we therefore should, the decision was made not to report it. And he was asking me for my advice on whether that should have been reported, and I said, of course, it should be. So I think this requirement is a reminder to professionals that their obligation to report continues, not just in the professional setting as it's currently in the law, but even when you're out mowing your lawn or interacting with neighbors or reviewing the work or the care that's going on within your own family of senior citizens. So I think this is an important provision of the bill and urge you to support it. One of the other aspects of the bill, and I know Detective Smith is going to mention this as well, but I want to affirm it from my own experience, is the extension of the statute of limitations. I currently have a case where we had a hearing before a judge on what's called a demur. In other words, I had charged a crime, the defense was objecting to charging that crime because it was outside the statute of limitations. And I made a valiant argument in front of the judge, but ultimately I think the judge was correct in ruling that that count had to be dismissed. And I'm talking about a count that involved over $10,000 taken from a senior citizen. The only reason that count was dismissed was because it was outside the statute of limitations as it was currently written. Now, here's a person who I'm still able to prosecute the person because there were subsequent attempts and successful attempts to take money from the person he was caring for. But the problem is that should never have happened. This was a financial abuse that was discovered by a conservator who there was some suspicion that this woman was being taken advantage of. A conservator was appointed, and it was through that work that we learned what was going on. Well, as you can imagine, sometimes these investigations, especially if they involve financial abuse, can occur over a number of months and sometimes a year and a half. There's a lot of work that goes into it. All that time is ticking away and going against us in terms of our prosecution. Extending the statute of limitations in this realm, when we're talking about crimes involving property, will bring us closer in line with statute of limitations that apply to criminal mistreatment. So this is not outside the norm. This doesn't go much further. It allows us to capture some crimes that we're currently not able to capture, and will ensure that seniors are protected, especially financially. One of the other aspects that Representative Gilliam talked about was the provision regarding MDTs. Now, in my role in Clackamas County, I mentioned that we have a multidisciplinary team. Clackamas County was one of the first, if not the first, county in the state to get our elder abuse MDT up and running. And we've been used as a model among other counties, so I say that with some pride. But there are a lot of counties, because I hear about this all the time, there are a lot of counties who don't have multidisciplinary teams because this is an unfunded mandate. And district attorneys, as you can imagine, are strapped with severe budget constraints. I can think of Josephine County as a particular example, where law enforcement has been scaled back, prosecution has been scaled back. And so the elected DAs are telling me, well, so here's another thing that we have to do, and I can't even prosecute all the crimes in my county that I have to prosecute. And that's a real concern. So what this provision does, it allows the district attorney to designate another agency, maybe a Department of Human Services, some other agency that has an interest in seeing that seniors are protected, to take some load off of the district attorney but allow the MDT to occur. I can tell you that in my county, and I share this with all the prosecutors who I can talk to, it has been a great asset to the way we prosecute and handle and investigate crimes against senior citizens. There's an enormous amount of communication that wasn't occurring before. Necessary communication. There wasn't the cross-reporting that needs to go on to make sure that we're holding offenders accountable and protecting senior citizens. So we want these multidisciplinary teams to occur and to thrive in counties, but district attorneys themselves aren't always in the capacity to chair that. So this gives some relief for that and can assure that those multidisciplinary teams occur.
John, I'm going to need you to wrap up because I want to get Matt's testimony. I've got three amendments I think you want us to move, and if you want us to move them, we need to wrap up as quick as we can so we can get those done.
That's easy for me to do. I also want to advocate for the eliminating the sunset of the provisions that allow us to work more closely with banks and better our investigations. So with that, I'm supportive of the amendments, the dash 6, 7, and 9. Those are fantastic additions to this bill as well.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Matt?
Members of the committee, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Matt Smith. I'm a detective with the Forest Grove Police Department. I also serve on the Elder Abuse Work Group. For the sake of brevity, I'll keep my comments brief. One of the most common questions I've encountered, especially meeting with some of you and talking with you, is do we have any examples of this bill working for law enforcement? And if you do, what are they? I wanted to briefly provide you with a couple examples of success stories, thanks to the work in House Bill 4084, and I hope with the passage of 2205 we can continue this. First and foremost, I want to echo Mr. Wentworth's comments regarding the statute of limitations. I recently had a significant financial exploitation case involving two victims, both stricken with dementia, involving an attorney who was also a municipal court judge, and he stole about $80,000 from these women, and he pled no contest to the charges several weeks ago. He's due to be sentenced at the end of the month. This is somebody who used their position of trust and authority and knowledge of the law to steal. And this investigation took me 3 years to complete. That's just the investigation. I began investigating it in 2010, and we're reaching adjudication in 2013. In the midst of trial preparation, I discovered financial transactions that I had completely overlooked and missed in the evidence. I had almost 10,000 pages of records, and upon going through them, discovered that there were some other concerning transactions on there. Initially, I was concerned these were outside the statute of limitations, but then I realized, thanks to the great work of the legislature and the work group, I had an extra 3 years. I had time to investigate this and hold this individual accountable, potentially. The other example I can give is I'm due to go to grand jury next week on an elder abuse case that is 3 years old. It's taken me 3 years to investigate, collect my records, and I can't overstate enough that when you're dealing with a victim with dementia, they're not able to communicate with you. And the goal for law enforcement is to investigate this case as thoroughly as possible and deliver a product to DAs like Mr. Wentworth where the investigation is complete, it's understandable, and unfortunately in a lot of these cases, most of my victims pass away before the case can even be adjudicated. These are enormous challenges for law enforcement, for the district attorney's office, and I cannot overstate enough how helpful this legislation has been and will continue to be. I'm willing to entertain any questions that you might have regarding these amendments or the legislation in general, and I can't thank you enough for your time and letting me testify.
Gentlemen, thank you. Questions? and I really want to focus really on the amendments, if anyone had any questions on those. If not, I want to thank you all very much. I have one other person, Gail Meyer, that wants to testify on this bill. Gail, please come forward.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. Members of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. With gratitude and humility, we support the Dash 6 Amendment. We had, and I want to thank Representative Gilliam and Hoyle and also John Wentworth. We wanted to work on tightening and narrowing down the statute of limitations so that there isn't an unintended windfall for these crimes, having an extended limitation period when there's really no aspect of it being a vulnerable victim. So if you had an expensive bike on a porch and someone stole the bike and it was a theft one, and you find out later that the owner of that bike is 67 years old, that limitation would be extended even though it really had no aspect of vulnerable elder abuse as a part of it. We tried to work with the DAs to come up with a fix. There's a fix in the A engrossed version, and it was Mr. Taylor who put his bright eyes on it, and he saw a problem to it, and he was right. Yeah, I won't get into the details of it, but the Dash 6 pulls the fix out. It leaves the six-year limitation period in. Quite frankly, we were scratching our heads trying to figure out how to tailor the extended limitation period to simply those cases where there is a vulnerable elder, and we couldn't get there quickly. We thought we had. We didn't. So we're comfortable at this point removing the fix, and if we have bright ideas, we'll come later.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. That's all the individuals I have scheduled to are wanting to give testimony. Was there anyone else on 2205? Not seeing anyone. We'll close the public hearing. Open the work session on 2205. Senator Dingfelder, Chair will entertain a motion on the Dash 6.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash A6 amendments be adopted into House Bill 2205.
Senator Dingfelder moves Dash A6 into House Bill 2205. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Is that the only amendment?
No. Okay. Chair will move Dash.
All of them?
Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the Dash A7s into House Bill 2205.
Senator Dingfelder moves the Dash A7s into House Bill 2205. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Chair, I move the Dash A9s be adopted into House Bill 2205.
Senator Dingfelder now moves the Dash A9s into the bill, House Bill 2205. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. All right. At this point, we're going to close the work session on this bill. We're going to get the fiscals done for the A6, A7, and A9s. That will get the bill back to us so we can then have the paperwork and we can decide in the subsequent work session to move the bill based on whether the fiscals show or don't show. Any other discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just, you know, I requested that the sponsors consider the A8s. I would also suggest that the committee members look at it and see if they think that's an appropriate piece to put in this as well.
The chair has looked at that. Senator Close was gracious enough to give me a copy yesterday. It actually is a repeat of a bill, Senate Bill 417,
right,
in its entirety. My discussions with Senator Close prior to yesterday was that I wanted to take this up in a interim work and actually look at the issue. This opens multiple doors regarding our corrections facilities.
Yes.
And it does. And we have not had the briefing or the opportunity to have the Department of Corrections or the Sheriff's Association or others to come forward and discuss it. So at this point, the chair plans to entertain this, as I said previously, during the interim period.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'm speaking for an absent member of the committee today.
So. And I've already told her,
okay.
Now she hears again, so does the general public.
Okay.
Any other questions? With that, we'll close the work session on 2205A, and we're going to go ahead and open up our last public hearing on House Bill 2963.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2963 comes to you from the House Committee on Judiciary. Provides that state law may not be construed implicitly to prevent city authority to control or regulate use of sidewalks, provides that city may not impose penalty greater than $250 fine under municipal laws relating to the use of sidewalks, declares emergency.
All right, thank you. Now, for those who are here to give testimony today on 2963, first let me tell you the bill is not moving forward today. In other words, we are not going to work session. All we're going to do is take public testimony. So I have about 9 people who want to testify, and I have about 30 minutes for this to occur. So we may be able to go a little bit over, but if I need to, I will reserve the right to have certain individuals not testify today that are regularly in the building so they can come back if we need to have additional public hearing. My goal is to get those individuals who have traveled some distance on the record today so you will not have to travel back. But I do need to start with those who are supporting the bill, and so I'm going to go ahead and call Bernie Bottomley and Lynn Ann Berg, if I'm not mistaken. Hopefully I did not butcher the names. And that's who I have listed for proponents for the bill.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Bernie Bottomley with the Portland Business Alliance. We're a membership organization, about 1,200 employers, small, medium, large employers in the Portland region. We're here to support 2963 on behalf of our members. The intent of the legislation is to address a very narrow issue, which is that Multnomah County Court found an ordinance that the City of Portland enacted invalid based on the preemption clause. The ordinance had to do with sidewalk management. It was called the SAFE ordinance, Sidewalk Access for Everyone. It was an ordinance that the Alliance and other partners and advocates in the city spent considerable amount of time working on. There was a lot of give and take in developing that ordinance. We proposed and got approval on that ordinance. It was appealed. One judge found that it was a model of the kind of give and take and compromise that should be employed in situations like this. Another judge later found that, in his opinion, the legislative history, of which there was none, indicated that the legislature intended for the disorderly conduct statute to preempt the city from engaging in an alternative approach to managing its sidewalks at the local level. So very simply, we are not asking you to engage in the kind of discussion that you had around drones and try to find the exact right mix of puts and takes on this issue. We're simply asking you to remove a barrier for us to have the conversation at the local level about more effective ways of managing the sidewalks. This isn't about speech or First Amendment or, you know, sort of the highfalutin constitutional issues that we hear about. It's simply about the language or the decision by the judge to decide that the state's disorderly conduct preempts the city from enacting management structures for its sidewalks. I know there's probably some question about whether this is a Portland-only issue and why should the legislature take it up. As you would imagine, these issues are very difficult to deal with, and they take a lot of effort at the local level, a lot of political investment on the part of both the advocates and the decision makers. And our experience since that decision is that they're loath to take up the issue, knowing that the preemption issue is there. There's not going to be an opportunity to move beyond that that barrier. So there's really not a stomach, no stomach for the kind of effort that it takes to craft a well-balanced ordinance at the local level if that preemption issue is hanging out there. So that's why we're here today, to ask you to give us the opportunity to have that conversation at the local level.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Lene Berg, and I'm the Executive Director of Downtown Clean and Safe, as well as a Vice President of Downtown Services for the Business Alliance. I'm also a retired police officer who spent 28 years serving the Portland community. I'm testifying today in support of 2963, which will really provide for an opportunity for a community discussion about creative solutions to the management of sidewalk conflicts. Our goal with House Bill 2963 is to provide cities with additional tools in resolving conflicting use of public sidewalks by clarifying that it was not the intention of the legislature to preempt local jurisdictions from employing those tools when it enacted the disorderly conduct statute. Because some courts have inferred that the legislature intended to preempt cities from employing local violations to manage sidewalks, we are left with the sidewalk management tools that are so constrained in their application that they are essentially ineffective in resolving conflicting uses. You can see on slide number 4 a picture of what happens on the sidewalks in Portland, that under the current ordinances, this picture displays this use of a sidewalk is allowed because of the city's ability to manage the use of the sidewalk extends only to the travel area between the building and the so-called furnishing zone. While the travel area can be kept clear, the furnishing zone has become a virtual free-for-all where people, belongings, and pets can obstruct both travel, commerce, and create sanitary impacts and degrade neighborhood quality. On page 5, you see an example of disabled drivers, and all drivers for that matter, who face the prospect of running the gauntlet to get to and from their cars. As we saw in the first slide, big groups and big dogs are just part of the issue. The dogs that often accompany these groups create other kinds of problems as well, occasionally attacking guide dogs or other service animals, as well as was documented in the Oregonian in 2010. Once attacked, most guide dogs cannot be retrained, meaning an investment of thousands of dollars and hours of volunteer time are wasted. As recent as April 2012, another guide dog was attacked in downtown Portland. Also, the impact on the economy is significant. We hear from conventions that they will not return to Portland because their attendees had such a negative experience. Visitors to Portland regularly email to say that they love the city but would hesitate to return due to the downtown environment. Longtime downtown firms are struggling to stay because their employees don't feel safe. Shop owners who work tirelessly to compete with suburban locations who offer free parking and controlled environments are losing customers who simply won't tolerate the fear and intimidation on the downtown sidewalks. There are a number of differing opinions about the city's previous efforts to craft a compromise sidewalk ordinance. Although one judge inferred state preemption, another judge, Multnomah County Circuit Court Judge Terry Hannon, found that the ordinance was not only constitutional, but that it was actually a good example of balancing the needs of various sidewalk users. At the end of the day, the burden should not be on those who are simply trying to use the sidewalks for their primary intended purpose, transportation, to enforce basic courtesy and decorum. But that's the effect of having the disorderly conduct statute preempting city ordinances. We are asking for the opportunity to explore ways to address these conflicts that do not run counter to the constitutionally protected rights of free speech and assembly and balance the need of sidewalk uses. We think that there are ways to achieve that balance, and with the passage of this measure, we will have a chance to explore them at a local level. Thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, questions? I've got 3 or 4. Written opinions, those two opinions are two decisions you've made reference to, the most recent one and the one back in 2008. Are there written opinions from the circuit court?
There's a written opinion for one and a transcript for the other.
I would like to have those prepared or provided to the committee.
Sure.
Why weren't those, the most recent one, why wasn't that appealed to the circuit, to the Court of Appeals?
You'd have to ask the City of Portland. We urged them to appeal. We offered to assist in the appeal. We offered to take the appeal on their behalf, and we were turned down.
All right. So for the committee, that opinion that's been rendered in Multnomah County is exclusively jurisdiction is in Multnomah County. It is not statewide. I've received correspondence inferring that somehow it has impacted the rest of the state. It has not. Then the last question, Lance, I guess I'm not sure in your presentation, it sounds like you want this bill to be passed so the community can have a discussion. Why do we need state action where you could, I think, be able to have these community discussions now in Portland and Multnomah County?
We could have the discussions, but the ability to enact legislation for the sidewalk similar to the sit-lie could not happen because of this preemption issue that was identified by Multnomah County judge.
All right. But unfortunately, the way I, not fortunately or unfortunately, the way I read the bill, you're also asking for state authority to actually create a penalty for individuals that may be in violation. So it doesn't seem like the bill itself addresses wanting to have a discussion. It's actually giving a sanction based on whatever might come out of those discussions.
Mr. Chair, if I might, and members of the committee, the interest there is not to create a sanction, but to create a limit to the sanction. So it could be less than that. The presumptive fine is 110 in Oregon Administrative Rule. So it's simply to provide a backstop that it could not be greater than that. It's not to say that the city must use that as a sanction.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank
what
you.
I'm going to do on the individuals that are wanting to give testimony on this, I've looked at the time and list. I'm going to call up four individuals first, and then I have three others that are more accessible to the Capitol. And if we need to, we will adjust the times for them. I believe it's Gretchen Bass?
Barr.
Okay. If you'd please come forward. David Richland, Amber Dunks, and Sophia. And let me just ask, if you've given written testimony, please don't read it in. We will look at it. If you've given us written testimony, give us just your summary and from your heart as to what this is. And also, and if one of you covers an area, please, in the brief time that we have, if you're not repeating each other, that would be wonderful. And you can say ditto to whatever. Thank you. Who'd ever like to get started? We do need to have your name.
Sure. I'm Gretchen Barr. I'm from Portland, Oregon, and I am speaking today on behalf of the group We Are Oregon. And I do have a brief statement on behalf of that organization. So We Are Oregon is a 5,000-person group that has been organizing with homeowners in the Portland area, fighting illegal and unjust evictions and foreclosures, which is a contributing factor to the growing houseless population in Portland. We believe that this bill is poised to sweep some of those same families that are being made homeless out of the public eye by forcing the sit-lie ordinances back on the table. We Are Oregon believes in community power and that any policy, if we need it, should be driven by those who most often lack a voice in this process. The members and families of We Are Oregon, most of whom are not houseless, insist that this proposal be voted down in solidarity with those that are houseless in our community. So we are asking that you kill House Bill 2963 and any other attempts to block individual public use of public space. We see that some businesses assert that this is a question of city's authority over the use of sidewalks and that there is an assertion that there is a state of emergency. We see that the only real emergency that is going on in our city is that everyday people are becoming homeless more and more every day. There are also some nonprofits that claim to represent the houseless community in support of this bill. But no one that had the interests of the houseless in mind would desire that those folks be swept under the rug or criminalized for the simple act of sitting on the sidewalk. Many of these people have nowhere else to go, and it's not right to be whitewashing our city of this issue. This bill not only affects those that need a place to sit, it also affects those who use sit-in or other immobile actions to voice our opinions and influence those in power. We believe that cities should not have the right to independently push what the state has clearly determined is oppressive, unjust, and unconstitutional. And we believe that the sidewalks and public spaces across the state must remain vibrant, inviting, and open to those most stripped of voice, whether those people are moving, sitting, or lying down. Thank you.
Thank you. Who'd like to go next?
I'll go next. My name is David Richland, and I'm also a member of We Are Oregon, and I'm here representing homeowners in the Portland area. I've been a resident of Portland and Oregon for over 30 years, and I own a home over in Southeast, close to downtown. And I just was one when I was called by the committee, by our committee, to speak on this. I was really, I have to be honest, I was upset at this attempt to criminalize homelessness. I moved to Portland, Oregon in 1980 because and when I got here, I really came to love this state and this city of Portland as a welcoming place for people and a place where I had an opportunity to go to school, graduated from Portland State University, worked my way up. I got a home over there. It's a friendly place and it's a welcoming place. And I think that to inhibit people's rights to be on the streets or to judge them as homeless, I don't know who's homeless or who's not homeless. Maybe some of the homeless people in downtown Portland are better dressed than others, and maybe some of the people who are affluent are less well-dressed. And for anybody else to judge who is not or who is homeless and whether they are or not, to infringe their rights to be on the streets or to peaceably assemble on the streets for any reason. These are our streets, the streets of the citizens. They don't belong to the Portland Business Alliance or any other people, other organizations. I pay my taxes. We all are citizens of the state, and they have a right to be on the streets. And I don't know what I'm reading in national news that they're shipping people out of Nevada to other places who are judged homeless or whatever, and this is injustice. I don't believe that this is the proper way to deal with a problem like this. We need to find housing for people. We need to provide jobs and opportunity for people, and the resources of our city shouldn't be wasted on police going after people who are judged to be homeless or not in the proper place at the proper time. This is a free country, and I think the streets, people should have a right to be on the streets. And that's what I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Amber, are you going to go next?
My name is Amber Dunks, and I'm the on-site organizer for Registrum 2, as well as the secretary of the board for the same organization. I'm also a part of Right to Survive, and I'm here to give a voice to the houseless community, many of which in Portland who could not be here today. The bill that you're considering, we have great concerns about. The current sidewalk management plan, as it is, unfairly targets the houseless population. There have been hundreds of citations issued for people simply just sitting on the sidewalk that have not been causing a disturbance. We in no way at Registrum to condone the behavior of the people who are panhandling aggressively and are causing a disturbance. The reason that people think that they're representative of the houseless community is because if your behavior is more out there, that's what people are going to see. The people that we see every day, which are in the majority, are the ones that are trying to get jobs. There's many people that have jobs, and we even have some people out there that are going to school. They're simply tired. They simply want to have a place to sit down. And under the current plan, which from what it sounds like from the folks at the Portland Business Alliance is a lot looser than what they would like it to be, many are already being penalized for the actions of the few. Why can they not simply come up with a plan that's within the guidelines of the state without this bill that would penalize the few for the actions of for their own separate actions? For what sounds like they're concerned about the public nuisance thing, The people that need to be criminalized are already creating the public nuisance. Don't allow a gateway for the further criminalization of houseless individuals who are simply just trying to sit down and rest and are not impeding traffic in any way. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Sophia?
Hi, I'm Sophia. I'm from Right to Survive, and we are a homeless organization made of homelessness and formerly homeless people, and we empower them of their civil, their constitutional, and their human rights. Currently in Portland right now, we are having major budget cuts. For this year, it's proposed that there will be $2,700 per month loss in housing. Service cuts will be down by 5%, over $180,000. They're cutting 300 houseless services to the actual people. 30 people will be out of permanent housing by the end of the year. Okay, so if we want to solve this issue of sidewalks, we need to solve the issue of houselessness. We shouldn't be focusing on one little issue and putting a Band-Aid on it and saying we've solved it, because we haven't. And we need to be working on increasing our resources and increasing our services. So on behalf of the houseless community and other organizations that represent the houseless community, we urge you not to move forward on House Bill 2963, and we thank you for hearing our voices.
Thank you. Questions?
I want to thank you all very much for coming to the Capitol to give your testimony. I also want to thank you for being very concise and succinct in what you told us. I think all of us heard it, and I really appreciate your time. I do just want to say one thing on the record. I know for homeless advocates and houseless advocates, the concern of having sanctions that are going to be impacting individuals that one can't afford it. What the way I read it now, it's not criminalizing, even though there would be fines involved. There would not be criminal labels placed there as a crime. But I did hear what you're saying, and we will take all of this in consideration. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And just a question: if they don't have the statute and they use the state statute, then they would be criminalized. Is that correct?
Under the state statute, if they meet the criteria, the elements of like disorderly conduct, that is a crime. It can, in fact, be reduced to a violation, which is what is proposed in the bill right now. That's non-criminal. But what I'm hearing at this point, it appears from the statements that have been made at this table, that there is a move to sanction individuals based on where the courts has come out and said that those are not unlawful actions by those individuals. So again, thank you very much for coming forward. So we have one other panel that I'm going to go ahead and call up at this point, and Monica Baraki, Becky Strauss, and Barbara Ross. I'd like to start with Monica, since I know that she's come in from Portland. And Becky and Barbara, I know both of you are here in the Capitol more frequently, and if necessary, we can have you come back. Monica, thank you for being here. If you give us your name and your testimony, please.
Thank you, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Monica Goracki. I'm an attorney in the Portland office of the Oregon Law Center, and the Oregon Law Center's mission is to achieve access to justice for vulnerable low-income Oregonians and their communities. I'll try to be as quick as I can, and I gave you some written testimony too. So I do have a couple concerns about the bill. One is I think that dispensing with the intent requirement in the disorderly conduct statute actually is not a small or narrow change. I think the element of intent is really important to protect free expression activities that occur on the sidewalk. My second concern really comes out of my experience with sidewalk ordinances, and that's just that I think this bill is unnecessary. I think, as your questions earlier, Chair Przanski pointed out, there really isn't anything preventing a community discussion about the range of options that are available to cities to regulate their sidewalks. There's nothing preventing any community from having a sidewalk ordinance, as long as the ordinance complies with state law, the federal constitution, the state constitution, and several cities do have sidewalk ordinances that are regularly enforced. So, you know, this isn't really a necessary thing. I think it's clear that what this bill would do is enable cities to pass expanded sidewalk ordinances. I think expanded ordinances really do run the risk of infringing on constitutional rights and the risk of being selectively enforced against certain groups of people, specifically homeless people, people with mental illness. I don't think that expanded ordinances work to solve the problems that the advocates of this bill are complaining about. And my reason for that belief is that I was part of a group that the City of Portland put together back in 2006 that negotiated the compromise that included a stricter sidewalk ordinance. And it also included additional services like restrooms and a day access center. So after that expanded ordinance was passed, we regularly monitored its enforcement. We looked at every single warning and citation that was given out. And many of them, I think nearly all of them, were given to homeless individuals. At the same time, there were business owners who were blocking the sidewalk with signboards and cafe tables, and those were not permitted. So they were actually also violating city ordinances. And we tried very hard, but we couldn't get the city to apply those laws equally against the business owners. So there was really this, you know, disparate impact. And the only people getting, you know, arrested and fined were people blocking the sidewalk. The other problem was the business community was actually unhappy, even with that expanded ordinance. And the reason is they weren't just, truthfully, they really weren't just concerned with people that were just sitting on the sidewalk. They were concerned about people asking for money, people being aggressive and noisy, and people in their large groups with the backpacks and the dogs, people with in the middle of a mental health crisis, and then people who are shoplifting or causing problems inside businesses. So when you read, you know, articles about the problems on the sidewalk, those are the kinds of problems that you really hear about, you see in those pictures. You know, we have existing laws against harassment and intimidation. I don't think that ordinances that you know, regulate sitting or lying or placing belongings on the sidewalk really get to those really problematic behaviors. Those you just have to address in some other way. And having an expanded sidewalk ordinance doesn't get you there. You can't make it illegal, you know, for people to have a mental health crisis. You know, you can't banish all dogs from the sidewalk. You can't make it illegal for people to hang out together in public. And you know, when people act rudely or are annoying, it's a problem and we should work on it. But passing this bill isn't really a good way to deal with that. And then just finally, the kind of last concern I have is that I think, you know, like the other panel said, using police to move people off the sidewalk really is not an effective way to solve homelessness. It leads to further conflict between police and people in mental health crises or people who are homeless. Makes the fines, the, you know, the penalties, whether it's a violation, even the violations, they make it harder for people to get jobs and actually end their homelessness. You know, a better solution, of course, would be to increase public resources for housing and mental health treatment. I know that's a tough thing to do, but that would really be much more effective than this bill. So sorry I went too long, but thank you for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you. Barbara?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Barbara Ross, and I am here representing myself as an individual, not any organized group. I understand that you have lots of bills with a lot of complexities, and I appreciate the work that you guys are doing with all of these bills. I think that I agree that in Portland we have really good, intelligent advocates on both sides, the business community and advocates for the homeless, and I think they're in a position to have a good, constructive talk about ways to solve problems and, again, addressing specific problems rather than just hoping that we'll sweep all these people away. I'd like to call attention to the impact this bill may have on smaller communities. What about Philomath? You know, what about Newport, Cottage Grove? These smaller communities have city council people that are volunteers, they're not attorneys, and the advocates on the other side who were talking about the homeless or low-income people or demonstrators or they're not attorneys either. And so in these smaller communities, giving them the encouragement to the opportunity to have more restrictive regulations and to these city councils change. You know, you have an election and the political climate changes, and I'm concerned about communities rushing to pass ordinances that may be unconstitutional or may be a burden to folks who want to demonstrate or who are exercising their free speech rights. So I would encourage you to look at the objections to the ACLU and think about the statewide ramifications of this particular bill and what it may, what the results may be in small communities where you have volunteers and less sophisticated people on both sides of the issue that are not attorneys and are not don't have the level of expertise to come up with sophisticated and effective and constitutional compromises. So I appreciate you're looking carefully at this bill instead of just passing without thinking too much about the unintended consequences. And I appreciate your time and the opportunity to testify on this bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We're now at 10 o'clock. So members, if you have other commitments that you need to go to, please feel free to do so. Chair will stay here to hear our last presenter.
Thank you, Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee. Becky Strauss here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. We're also here in opposition to this bill, and I want to be associated with the comments of the prior two witnesses. I think they covered almost everything that I wanted to say. I want to just make reference to an additional letter from an organization called Street Roots and a couple additional signatories that is in the written record. Just hope you have a chance to look at their reasons for opposition as well. And just want to make mention, I want to take a second to challenge the assertion that that the circuit court case in Multnomah County is a barrier to a conversation in Portland. And beyond even being a barrier to a conversation, which I know that question, Chair Brzozinski, you raised, I want to challenge the idea that the case preempted any type of sidewalk management ordinance. The case did not say that sidewalk management ordinances are preempted. What it said was that regulating obstructing traffic was preempted, and because that the reason for that is because our state disorderly conduct statute regulates the exact same conduct, and that statute has an intent element. Of course, we know that the intent element in that statute is very important to the protection of free expression rights, and so we're worried that what this bill would do by preempting that statute, we think it's unnecessary to do so in Portland, and it may have ramifications for free expression rights beyond the context of what's happening here. So I believe and we're concerned that the intent of the proponents of this bill is to expand the reach of the ordinance. Monica mentioned that. We have a sidewalk ordinance now in Portland. It was negotiated and developed after this circuit court decision. So clearly the decision did not preempt a conversation. We had a conversation. And we have a sidewalk ordinance now that is enforced with some regularity. I apologize that I don't kind of know exactly how often or who is being directly affected specifically. But I think the concern is that what the Business Alliance is intending to do is move more toward an obstructing traffic type of ordinance, which is concerning because it's more vague. It opens the door for disparate impact on certain people in certain places, really at the discretion of the law enforcement officer. And so those are our concerns. We hope that you will refrain from moving the bill this session and allow us to engage in the type of conversation that the proponents are looking for in Portland. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, comments? I will just state that that's why one of the reasons I asked for opinions, because I need to read them to see exactly what the court ruled and what was actually the holding in those two. So that's very important for the chair to have, and I do want committee members to get those. So I appreciate you making those available to the committee as soon as possible. With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2963. And again, I want to thank everyone who's come to Salem, to the Capitol, to give us testimony on this bill.